militarism and increasing Canada's militarism, even though he makes various statements. I know I saw that he a couple of days ago maybe said that Canadian military money, the amount going to the US is not going to be the same. But Carney has been very clear through his statements as well as actions that he is really committed to Canadian militarism. And so, unfortunately, I don't think we have a lot of hope that he will, on his own accord, or the government of Canada on its own accord, will uphold its legal duty. I think we've seen that in various ways. We saw the Bill C-233 vote a couple months last month, where the majority of the Liberals voted no. And so I think the reality we have to come to is that we're not going to see the government take action without significant and probably various types of pressure. I think he's been very clear, and now that they have a majority government, I think that only becomes more of the reality that we have to contend with.
What can individual Canadians do? Do individual Canadians have power insofar as getting Canadian financial institutions to divest from Israeli criminal activity?
Absolutely. So a couple things. One, you can contact your financial institution and let them know if you're with one of the entities in this report. Let them know about the report, let them know about their investments. That's not to say that will change their investments necessarily if it's one of these big corporations, but it does matter that they hear public opinion. If you're looking to change your banking or your investments, if you have personal investments, you can reach out to the prospective credit union or local bank and ask them to disclose their investments. We will be releasing in the next few days a resource guide with some templates to be able to do this to make it a little bit easier. You can, if you're part of a pension plan, again, write to them, let them know. The reality is that individual pressure on its own won't necessarily change things, but there are a lot of amazing organizing efforts happening. So if you're part of a pension plan and you want to get involved in organizing, there's probably a group already doing that, and we can happily connect you with those people, because what we need is organized public pressure. And so while you as an individual can take important action in contacting your institutions, perhaps even more importantly is getting involved in the broader effort to increase the pressure on these institutions to be held accountable.
Becca Steckel is a campaigner with the Canadian human rights group Just Peace Advocates that has just released a report on April 9th exposing 100 Canadian financial institutions that have investments totaling over half a trillion US dollars in companies complicit in Israel's occupation, apartheid, and genocide. We'll link to Just Peace Advocates' report at the Green Planet Monitor. Becca, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me. I'm very glad to talk about this report, and hopefully, we just keep on pushing, we keep on going, and I appreciate you having me.
Becca Steckley is a campaigner with the Canadian human rights group Just Peace Advocates. For a link to their report and our complete conversation with Becca Steckley, go to greenplanetmonitor.net. You are listening to the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Canadian financial institutions have invested in Israel's occupation of Palestine to the tune of over a half trillion US dollars and are therefore complicit in Israeli policies and practices judged to be unlawful by the International Court of Justice and other human rights bodies. Of course, they're playing with dollars of individual Canadians. Do individual Canadians have the power to control how their dollars are invested? The GPM spoke about this with Peter Larson. Larson is an Ottawa-based researcher and blogger and the chair of the Ottawa Forum on Israel-Palestine, OFIP. The GPM reached Peter in Ottawa. Thank you so much for coming back on the Green Planet Monitor, Peter. And I'm wondering if you can kind of reflect on, like, first of all, tell me how you respond, what your reaction is to this report from Just Peace Advocates, because it's not surprising that Canadian corporations who are out there, they're some of the biggest corporations in the world, and they're out there in the world, and many of them invest in, and banks invest in Israel. So it's really not surprising, although it's shocking to read about it. How does this hit you, this report?
Well, I think it's an amazing report. They've obviously done a huge amount of research, and my hat goes off to them for doing that. It follows along in the same line as Francesco Albanese's report, the title of which escapes me for the moment, but it's like financing genocide or something like that, where she listed a very large number of international corporations that were involved in making money in a collaboration with Israel, including in some of the work specifically involved in the genocide in Gaza. So I think this is a narrower focus looking at the involvement of Canadian banks and institutions, and I think it's useful information.
And does it shock you? Or are you inured to this?
No, well, I mean, it is shocking, but it doesn't shock me, and probably doesn't shock you either, or perhaps even many of the people who are listening to this, because we're already largely sensitized to it. But I don't think my next door neighbor or the neighbor beyond that or the people who belong to my tennis club would be aware of this. And it would be undoubtedly, well, surprising. Whether they would be shocked or not, I don't know. But they should be shocked, and they probably would not know this information.
And what, I mean, I'd like to dive into what your own thoughts on you know, you'd like to do something personally, and you're grappling with what to do. But before we get into that, what really shocks me, standing back from all this, is how little international law counts for, how the United Nations Charter has been effectively debased, in my view, and, you know, the Genocide Convention, the Geneva Conventions. I mean, the rule of law, Israel and the United States have really proven since October 2013, if anybody doubted it, they've proven that international law really counts for nothing, zero, and impunity is total and complete, certainly for Israel. This is my opinion. And so this shocks me that, you know, all these things are flagrantly unlawful, and yet here we've got Canadian corporations investing wildly in all these activities when, of course, investments in Ukraine, well, in Russia. I mean, I was checking this up on the internet today. What's the status with the legal status of investments in Russian banks and Russian oil and gas companies and Russian arms manufacturers? It's all banned, but right. Israel, no.
Well, I think it's a challenge for individuals. I agree with you. I think it's been widely commented on the fact that the case of Gaza in particular has shown how weak and ineffective international law is, and how hypocritical Western countries, not just Western countries, but Western countries have been using international law when it suits their purposes and ignoring it when it doesn't. So in terms of the investment, in particular, focus on the investment, I think there are a couple of things. One is that I think that we have to remember that these big investment firms, they're under pressure to maximize their return on their investment for their shareholders, for their, something like the Ontario Teachers Fund. The chair or the president of the Ontario Teachers Fund will get his bonus based on, in part, on the return on investment. So for someone who's directing a major pension fund, and it's more broadly, to have to be constrained in certain ways, whether it's for environmental reasons or whether it's for genocide or whatever, is a problem for them that they have to work around, because their bottom line is to manufacture the best return on investment for their owners or their principals. So that doesn't mean we can't put pressure on them. We could and should. There are such things as ethical investment funds, for example, with respect to environmental concerns. I'm sure you're aware of that, David. It's probably something we've worked on in the past. So I have written to my either my investments, my modest investments, or with an investment advisor, and I have written to them and say, please check and make sure that none of my investments directly are either with Israeli companies or with Israel bonds. And I explained in my letter to them why I held that position, and that they were able to get back to me, and they did assure to me that that was the case, and that I had actually spoken to them about that verbally a couple of years ago. This time I wrote a letter and said, please confirm for me that's the case. That was a fairly easy thing for them to do. But with the current report, the very extensive report, I didn't quite know what to do with it with respect to my advisor. For example, one of the things that the report focuses on is a number of the banks. Well, I happen to do one, my investments with a specific bank. Let's say the Royal Bank. It's not the Royal Bank, but say it's the Royal Bank. I can't very well say to them, well, if you don't smarten up, I'm going to go to another bank, because as we all know, they're all involved. So that's kind of a like waving a finger without having really anything behind it. And I was wondering whether I could mail my or email the report to my investment advisor. And it occurred to me that that really put too much of a demand on her to have to go through the report and then try to compare all the things that were reported to against my particular investments. That wasn't going to work very well either. So I was left a little bit puzzled as to how I could make best use of the very good research and reporting in the report.
And you're the sort of person, Peter Larson, who would write a letter to your bank or to your investment manager. I mean, I read many of the letters that you send out, and then you BC various BCC people, and you're writing to media outlets and political figures, and you're incredibly articulate, and it takes time to write these letters. And I think very often one gets responses. I mean, always one gets responses. One has to jog people. But you're very good at doing this, and you do this. And but not everybody is comfortable with doing this. Not everybody knows how to do this.
Well, I think you
Nor is quite practiced at writing a really good letter and then being, polite and being persistent, because
right.
that's what it takes. A lot of people doing that.
Well, I agree. It's not every, some people, I think in this general field of trying to promote human rights, different people act according to their own skills and their own abilities and their own interests. So I think of it, David, as kind of like an orchestra. Some people play the trombone and some do the drums and some are on the piano. You're very good at doing your podcasts that reach a lot of people, and good for you for doing that. I'm not as skilled as you are in that area, but I am a reasonably good letter writer. I've had a lot of experience on it. And so I send a letter to, for example, Prime Minister Carney and BCC hundreds of people, in hoping that some of them will pick up the letter and forward it to him or whoever I'm writing to, rather than having to write their own letter. On the question specifically of what letter you might write to your financial advisor, I can send you, if you want, a draft of the letter that I, a very simple letter I wrote to my own financial advisor. That letter had two objectives. One was to actually get the person to do the review, but the other is to do a tiny bit of education, saying, why would I want to not invest in either Israeli firms or Israeli bonds?
You think it makes a difference if a
I
lot
think
of people
everything.
do this?
David, of course, I have no direct way of measuring it. I think that everything makes a difference. How much of a difference it makes, I can't measure it. But we know that, for example, there is or was a great deal of environmental sensitivity. A number of financial firms have decided to offer portfolios, baskets of environmentally friendly investments, and they do that. Whether or not that would be possible, we could structure that, or someone suggests how to structure it with respect to Israel specifically, or observance of international law more generally. I think that would be more difficult to frame.
You may be aware, I mean, standing back from this and moving back into the general topic, you may be aware that there's now there are now attempts to get, and there have been for some while, the European Union, the European Council, I guess it would be the European Union, to terminate or suspend its various free trade agreements with Israel, and like the Horizon Agreement and the EU-Israel Free Trade Agreement. And now, especially in the wake of the change in government in Hungary and the rising of a new prime minister who may be less inclined to block the European Union in its attempts to sanction Israel. And this is happening in Europe right now.
Right.
And I'm wondering, geez, I wonder what, you know, Mark Carney, who's looking out, looking east towards Europe, away from the United States, that can't be trusted anymore in the realm of trade and finance and cooperation, looking towards the EU and seeing the EU possibly now terminating its trade agreements with Israel. You think Carney, can you imagine Mark Carney terminating the Canada-Israel Free Trade Agreement? And by the way, and at the same time, we've got this new thing called the Defense, Security, and Resilience Bank that Just Peace Advocates refers to as an international war bank, which it is, 18 countries setting up a new multilateral financial platform that would bring together like-minded partners to mobilize and deploy private capital and support collective security in the area of defense and security. And who else would they be looking towards? I mean, Israel is not part of this, one of these 18. Israel is not. But, I mean, the Canadian Coast Guard is testing Elbit drones over the Arctic. So Canada is just, Carney is just looking at the Israelis, as did Trudeau, for trade and investment and technology and all that stuff. And now, you know, we're asking him to sort of divest, get corporations to stop investing in Israel. It's a lot to chew on there.
Yeah, there is I didn't know you were going to ask me these questions, so I don't have the numbers in my head, but I know that Europe does a huge amount of trade with Israel and vice versa. In fact, Canada's trade with Israel is puny.
Europe is Israel's number one trade partner.
Pardon?
Europe
Yes,
is
yes.
Israel's
Yeah.
number one trade
Yeah.
region.
Yeah. You can verify the exact numbers I have here, but approximately by noon on January 1st, we have done as much trade with the United States as we will do with Israel in a whole year. Like our trade with Israel is very, very small. And
Yes.
as a result, our Canada-Israel Free Trade Agreement, CFTA, is actually not really much about trade. It is a political document about forcing through, whether it's at the provincial level or the federal level, our affection for, our alliance with, our enthusiasm for Israel. That's really what the CFTA is all about. Its actual economic impact is pretty minor. It's Canada has two kinds of free trade agreements, some of which are consequential, like the one with the United States. But we've negotiated a number of free trade agreements with other countries that are really political expressions. I've done quite a bit of work on our free trade agreement with Chile, which falls in that category. So I just don't think you should overplay. It's not insignificant, but its economic impacts are not particularly consequential, either for us or for Israel. But politically, it's very important.
Huh. And so politically, I would imagine, politically, it's very important for people to get together and write letters to their banks and their pension funds. And I think collectively, who knows what impact they'll have, but the fact that they're doing it and talking with others about doing it,
Right.
and they're entering into a broader debate about Canadian investment in these kinds of activities, that has considerable political impact.
I think that's right, David. And I think, for example, one could write to Carney saying that we want to ensure, we want to limit our free trade agreements to countries that are in compliance with relevant international law and the Geneva Convention. We could also do that with your investment advisors. So please make sure that my investments are only with companies and organizations that are not under UN sanction. That would be something as easy. But should do that with the expectation that probably that's more of an educational statement than it is of one that's going to cause it. Because unless we were to choose four organizations and say, we think these four Canadian organizations are the most egregiously involved, like was done, for example, with Bank of Nova Scotia around the, was it the Giller Prize? It was one of the...
Yes.
Yeah, and that was very effective. That was, Bank of Nova Scotia was involved in Elbate, and that was a very focused campaign, and that was a very effective public relations campaign, which forced the Bank of Nova Scotia, as I understand it, either to back off completely or at least partially their involvement with Elbate, and I think they're no longer directly involved with the Giller, but I'm not exact. But that campaign had an impact.
Huh. Peter, I've not asked you, thank you so much for your time. I didn't ask you to introduce yourself. I would have done it just before our conversation. But can you tell me about the Ottawa Forum on Israel-Palestine, sure. What it is, what you do? It's been around for a while, and you've been with it for years.
Yeah, so we're an educational organization, kind of like Green Planet Monitor is as well. We do a series of activities. I do a monthly webinar where I invite people from around the world who are knowledgeable in various aspects of the Israel-Palestine question. Our mandate is to educate Canadians in order to push the Canadian government towards a policy with respect to Israel-Palestine, which is based on human rights, democracy, and international law. I also write frequent letters you referred to earlier. To, for example, the head of the CBC or the prime minister or a university president, trying to flag something that I think they have done that deserves attention and they should have to respond to. I try to make my letters very polite and try to so that they are and to not over be excessive in my demand. So I try to make them letters that can be easily shared with lots and lots of kind of like you would write a letter to the editor, sort of. But not being very successful in getting my letters to the editor in the Globe or in the Star. This is my backup. And then the final thing I do is I write a weekly blog post at www.ottawatalksisraelpalestine.ca, and it focuses on the nexus between Israel, Palestine, and Canada. So it can be things that are happening in Canada, like the election of Avi Lewis and what it means for Canada's position on Israel-Palestine, or it could be on Canada refusing to allow Palestinian leaders of Palestinian Soccer Federation to come to Canada, on various issues that are going on.
Well, Peter, I'm grateful for your time, and keep writing those letters. They're always... I'm always impressed by them. Why do you think it's so hard to get your letters onto the op-ed pages of Canada's major newspapers?
David, why do you think it's so hard for me to get my letters in the op-ed pages of Canada's major newspapers? You know as well as I do. We live in Canada. We swim. I'll leave you with this. We swim in a political bath of liberal Zionism. Most Canadians, all our public parties, political parties, all our churches, they all, on the one hand, really don't like what Israel's doing in Gaza. They really don't like what Israel's doing to the Palestinians in the West Bank. But at the same time, they defend the right of Israel to exist. So they end up being handcuffed. They don't know what to say.
And of course, that's such a nonsensical idea. Does Israel have the right to exist? No country has the right to exist. There is no such right in law to exist. Like Russia doesn't have the right, you know, the USSR didn't have the right to exist, right? America doesn't have the right.
How about Canada?
And Canada, it's got sovereign borders.
I think you're right, although at the same time, now, I'm going to be doing a webinar on this in about a month on Israel's right to exist, because I totally agree with what you just said. No country has a right to exist. There's no such legal right. But we also know that when someone challenges you that way, that's not really the question. They are trying to suss out from you your hatred for Jews or your desire that something terrible to happen to the Jews. And so that's really the question that's in the, even if you win the debating point, you haven't solved the bottom issue. So I'm going to try to talk about how to tackle this. So,
Peter Orson, thank you so much for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
And thank you, David, and thank you to the Just Peace Advocates for the work that they've done. And let's hope we can use it to, what's the phrase, to turn the arc of justice a little bit better in the right direction.
Bend it closer towards justice.
That's right. That's it. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Peter Orson is an independent researcher and blogger based in Ottawa, Canada. He was the founding chair of the Middle East Study Group of the Canadian International Council, board member of the National Council on Canada-Arab Relations, and the first chair of its National Education Committee on Israel-Palestine. Peter is the longtime chair of OFIP, the Ottawa Forum on Israel-Palestine. Learn more about OFIP and Peter Larson at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a joint production of Earth Chronicle Productions and 93.3 CFMU-FM, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. Thanks to our news editor, Kylie Wong. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. You can also find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Blueberry, and on Canada's Harbinger Media Network. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out for now.
You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
An urban ecologist, and I'd like to give you a crash course on urban birding. There's nothing like the sound of the eastern towhee reminding you to drink your tea first thing in the morning. In the eastern U.S., these are not birds you have to travel far to see. In fact, you can see the eastern towhee and many other birds just by taking a walk around your neighborhood. One of the reasons I love birds is that you don't have to go far to find them. You can sit on your porch, at your local park, or even in the parking lot of your favorite store, and you will find birds. All it takes is at least 5 minutes of mindfulness. If you don't see anything right away, don't be discouraged. Remember to look up. Maybe you will catch a vulture soaring overhead on a warm, breezy day, or the flash of red on a red-tailed hawk as it soars by. Check the power lines, light poles, and tops of buildings for the electric blue flash of the eastern bluebird. Close your eyes. Listen. Past the sounds of the cars and the traffic, past the sounds of people chatting nearby. Do you hear it? Drink your tea. This week is Blackbirders Week. To learn how to participate, follow the hashtag Blackbirders Week on social media and visit birdnote.org. I'm Deja Perkins.
You can deny all the things I've seen, all the things I've discovered, but not for much longer. because too many others know what's happening out there.
I want to believe.